Pastor Monsignor Marino, who is unable to be here today, I would like to welcome you to Our Lady of the Assumption Church and to the first joint presentation of the Tredyffrin Easttown Historical Society and the Radnor Historical Society. Our parish is thrilled to be hosting this special presentation. First, I would like to thank Mike Bertram from the Tredyffrin Easttown Historical Society for his interest and who first approached us about a presentation. Also from TE, Denny Lieber and Heidi Sprode, who is also a parishioner. From the Radnor Historical Society, Ted Pollard. And we would especially like to thank Roger Thorne from TE Historical Society, who gave so much of his time and help with the equipment, teaching PowerPoint to Christine and I, which was a new skill. None of this would have been possible without you, so thank you very much, Roger. My name is Celia Palantonio, and my great-grandparents and grandparents were among the early Italian immigrants who helped found this parish. Our Lady of the Assumption was founded as an Italian immigrant parish, and is celebrating its centennial anniversary this year, 2008. In the early stages of planning for this historical occasion, I was asked to chair a committee that would research the history of the parish and ultimately produce a book. I had never heard my grandparents talk about what it was like for them in Italy, why they came to the United States, or what it was like for them when they arrived. They never talked about it. I knew I had a lot to learn, and I had no idea what I was in for. Well, thanks to a fantastic history committee, and 2.5 years and hundreds of hours spent researching in libraries, historical centers, county offices, poring over maps, photographs, and sometimes the conditions weren't all that pleasant. We were in basements that were wet and damp. But we uncovered an incredible story of hardship, persistence, humility, love of family, love of God and church, and love of country. What an extraordinary example our grandparents set for us. And we want everyone to know this history. I knew we needed a person who would be willing to join me in the enormous amount of time and sleepless nights, and who was gifted in putting all this information into words. I did not know Christine Gaito at the start of the project. Fortunately for me, she quietly entered one of our committee meetings and accepted the challenge of authoring our history book. In this hour-long presentation, we could not possibly tell you the details that are in the upcoming history book. Much of what you hear today didn't even make it into the history book. But what we will be sharing with you today is why so many Italians left Italy to settle in this area, what Stratford was like 100 years ago, and how our parish began. So at this time, I'm just going to turn over the microphone to Christine, and in her beautiful words, she's going to tell the story.
Thank you, Celia. Thank you all for coming. We're going to have a little thing going here. Celia's going to change the slides, and I'm going to be operating the microphone and the pointer, so we'll try to make it as smooth as possible. Okay. The first slide is our Jubilee logo, which depicts here our church under the protection of Our Lady of the Assumption, and that was our guiding light through the project. Can you all hear me? So when we began researching the book, these were the questions that we had to answer before we could begin understanding how the church came to be. We first had to find out why was there an Italian church in this area to begin with? Why were there so many Italians in the Stratford area? Why did they leave Italy to come here? And why did they end up here? And then when they came over about 100 years ago, what did they find? What was it like in the Stratford area? And finally, how was the church, the parish and the church, established? So some facts we came up with right at the beginning. In the period between 1880 and 1924, 25 million immigrants came to the United States. Out of that, almost 20% were from Italy alone. And of those, almost 90%, the majority, came from the southern states of Italy, southern regions. And this was only one-third of the actual amount that left Italy. The number of emigrants out of Italy was closer to 10 million. They went to other countries such as Argentina, Canada, and Australia as well. So we had to begin our story in Europe and in Italy. And there's Italy in Europe. And we had to go back to Italy, or at least the peninsula of Italy, in the 1850s. Italy at this time was not yet a country. It was not one political entity. Italy was the name given to the peninsula. It was what they called a geographical title, or a concept. What happened between the periods of 1860 and 1870, gradually these independent states, each of these little states were independent under a different government, gradually over time, over the period of 10 years, they joined together to form one country, the Kingdom of Italy, under Victor Emmanuel II, the new king. The region we are particularly concerned with is the south, the southern Italy, all of which, before unification, was part of what was called the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, under the rule of a foreign king who was actually from Spain, the Spanish line of the Bourbon kings. The rulers were very disliked. The people, this region was in particularly bad shape, and unification was told, at least they were told, that unification would bring them more prosperity, a better life. And in fact, it was quite the opposite. Things got even worse. So, the terrain of Italy was very important in the type of life that people led. It's a very mountainous country with the Apennine Mountains running down the whole peninsula. And it determined the sort of living that people could make. Mostly an agricultural country, and a lot of the agriculture is in very small farms, hillsides. There's a lot of sheep farming, a lot of goat herding, a lot of pastoral, rural agriculture type of living. This is a modern map of Italy showing all the regions that make it up, 20 regions that make it up. And Italy is now a republic since 1948, although back in 1870 it was a kingdom, a constitutional monarchy. What the region, of course, that we're interested in is this Abruzzo and down Campania, Molise, and all this area here. That is southern Italy, used to be the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, as we said, and once unified became known as the Mezzogiorno, which means midday. Which is the name that the Italians from the north gave to the southern regions. And this is Victor Emmanuel II, the new king. When Italy was unified as the kingdom in 1870, the population was about 27 million, 90% of which were engaged in agriculture as peasants, and two-thirds of which were just subsistence farmers, which means they did not make enough They make just enough to live day by day, no savings, they could not ever improve their lot. 80% were illiterate. When unified, they had no concept at all of being part of a country called Italy. It meant nothing to them. Their loyalty was to their town or village. And it's in fact not until they emigrated and came to another country that they were labeled as Italian. Before that, they were simply from Benevolences or Calabrese or some. It's actually really more to the town or village that they came from. There was no common language. The particular geography of Italy ensured that even areas that were very close to each other could not had mutually unintelligible languages. They had been separate for so long. The language chosen for the country was the Tuscan dialect, of which only 2.6% spoke. 2.6% of the population spoke that language, so it was a just quickly. And another thing, when Italy started out as a country, they inherited the debt from the previous kingdom of Sardinia, from where the king came, and so they started out with debt, very poor, and the Italian workers were among the lowest paid in Europe, so it wasn't a very great condition. This is the Mezzogiorno before 1870, while it was still under the rule of the Bourbon kings. The population was about 8 million, so about 30% of the entire peninsula of Italy. 88% were illiterate. They were even worse shape in the north. 90% lived in little mountain villages, mostly agricultural and pastoral. Some industry that was mostly related to wool and sheep. It was a virtually feudal society. The wealthy landowners that were foreign would have their lands farmed by tenant farmers who really were dependent entirely on their existence on these landowners. 1,621 of the 1,848 villages in the south had no roads. However, because the rulers were somewhat paternalistic, the taxes and food prices were kept low, and in addition, industry was protected because it was just within that kingdom that the industry had no competition from outside. This is the Mezzogiorno then that we're talking about. And after 1870, contrary to what they had been told, the land was now given to landowners from the north. All the nine lands that were confiscated from the previous foreign rulers were now given to people from the north. Most of them did not live there. And because the northern part was also concerned with improving the industry and agriculture in the north, the south was pretty much neglected. A free trade policy within all of Italy ensured that the protection that the people had enjoyed, the people in the south had enjoyed in their industry before, was gone, and now they had to compete with the rest of Italy for their commerce. Taxes went up because of the debt that Italy started out with. Food prices increased. For some strange reason also, which the population increased by almost 30% between 1870 and 1900. Poor farming methods meant that most of the land was badly farmed and therefore after a short time exhausted. And so that led to deforestation as people cleared land to make for more arable farmland. Deforestation led to erosion, which led to flooding. Flooding also caused malaria to spread, and impure water meant that there were cholera outbreaks, and there was one in the late 1800s that killed almost 55,000 people. There was an agricultural crisis then in 1880 causing famine, and on top of that there were earthquakes and volcanic eruptions and all around bad stuff going on. Poverty and starvation was pretty much the norm at the time. So, but the situation of the southern Italians had gone from bad to worse, and so something had to give. solution. And at this time, beginning already in about 1860, there had been a trickle of Italians that had already begun to emigrate. And some had gone to this country, and they came back with stories about this country being a land of a promised land where the streets were paved with gold. This was a sort of a rumor that it was beginning to spread. America, they called it. And people would come back to their village with $100, an outrageous amount for them, and talk about how with hard work you could come to this country and earn a good living, even make a fortune, and come back to Italy and have a great life. So, starting in about 1880, people had already begun, because of the crises in the South, had begun already to move around and within Italy itself looking for work, and were sometimes gone 2 months, several months at a time, 2, 3, 4 months at a time from home. So migration was already a fact of life for many. Another reason that emigration came up, of course, is the desperation that most people had with their lot. They were barely able to survive. So starting in about 1870, people started to emigrate, usually initially mostly young single men between the age of about 16 to 40. They would come with the idea of making a fortune and coming back home. It must be said that most of the Italians that left with the idea of coming home. They did not want to leave Italy. They just needed to find some money, come back, and bring a little more prosperity to their lives. So up to 1900, mostly young single men would find jobs, live for a while, and then return home and continue living in the land of their birth. Later, of course, those who ended up staying here and could not go back because of the work that they had begun sent for their wives and children. So starting in about 1900, wives and children came to join their husbands, and still with the idea of returning. No one ever, I don't think very many people came with the idea of settling permanently. So wives and children came to join their husbands and settling in this country. We're going to speak in particular about Abruzzo, which is the province, the region that most people from this parish come from. And in particular, the town of Teramo, which is the capital of a province called Teramo by the same name, the most northerly of the four provinces that make up Abruzzo. This is Abruzzo here, a topographical map. You can see from this map that about two-thirds of the country is mountain, and about another third is low hills sloping down to the sea. Because of its peculiar geography, it had remained very isolated for centuries, and people were... This particular province was actually less well off than the further south. It was, because of being isolated, it had become somewhat self-sufficient and without the competition from other areas. There is no place for a harbor. It's not a coastline. It's a harbor, so there was no commerce from the sea as well. With the advent of the railroad in about 1870, there was a railroad built along the coast here. With the advent of that, of course, the region was opened up to the rest of Italy, and that's when things started to go more downhill for the Abruzzese. So, this is the town of Teramo today. It's a beautiful, the Abruzzo is beautiful with the mountains here, the Apennines to the west, yes. We are going to trace the journey of some people in order to illustrate what an immigrant would have to go through, what an Italian would have to go through in order to immigrate into this country. So we're going to talk first about a young man Francesco Paolo di Lorenzo, who left a little village called Colle Santa Maria, which is a little further north of this town of Teramo. He left, he left Italy in 1891, immigrated to the United States, and ended up in Ohio working for the railroad. In 1894, he became a U.S. citizen. Most immigrants were encouraged to become citizens in the idea that they would then become assimilated and better citizens. And at the top, moving on. So he came to Ohio, and then at some point he moved to Pennsylvania. And then a little later, in 1903, he came back to his native village to look for a wife. Rosaria Cimini, this is what she looked like in 1903, is actually the foundress of our parish. So we're particularly interested in her history, or her story. She, Francesco, found and married her in 1903. And now we're going to see what her journey was like as she came to the United States. So at this time, as we said, the railroads had been built. So she would have been, Teramo is probably where the Y of Italy is here. She would have taken a train to the coast, my hand is shaking, train to the coast, and then taken the train down here to Foggia, and from Foggia across the peninsula to Naples. All immigrants from the south left from either Naples or Palermo. Those from Sicily, of course, left from Palermo. So, at Naples, she would have boarded a boat and been put on a manifest. A ship manifest was a list that the captain of the ship used to list all the passengers on, not all the passengers, all the third class passengers on his ship. And on there were their names and all the details, some information about them that the United States immigration customs officials needed to know about them. So, Rosaria actually tried to, well, make two attempts at immigration. On June 11th, 1903, she boarded a ship called the Sicilian Prince. And as you can see down here in the blue circle, there are her name and her, she was traveling with her brother, Pietro. But you can also see that their names are crossed out. So they never made it across on this ship. They had to get off. We don't know why, but they did get off the ship. And a couple weeks later, they ended up on this ship called the Neapolitan Prince. What I've highlighted here with the arrow is out of the 1,175 passengers that this ship could carry, 25 were first class and 1,150 were third class. Steerage, also known as steerage. So the third class, of course, were those that sat here in the bowels of the ship, not sat, lived. Okay. So she now shows up on this manifest. There they are, Pietro, her brother, and Rosaria. Some details on this manifest that are recorded. And of course, there was an inspector who would get on the ship in Italy and ask all these questions and fill out these forms. And upon arrival in the United States, all these facts would be cross-checked to make sure that the that the immigrants were telling the truth and that it was in fact as they had recorded before leaving. So this is what was entered by the ship official, still in Naples. Masculine, feminine here at the sex, married or single. Rosaria is married and Pietro is single. Their occupation is the next column. Pietro was a laborer and Rosaria says, it says wife. This next column here is whether they are able to read or write. As you can go, if you go down the column, you can see that mostly it's no, and just the two people on this list, Rosaria being one, and somebody else, Pio Adriani here, who went somewhere else, could read or write. And for a woman, a young woman in Italy, to be able to read or write was extremely unusual. Rosaria was an unusual person right through to the end. So, she was able to read or write. Next recorded is the country of origin, so Italian, and then what they call race or people. Back then, the Southern Italians were considered a different race from the Northern Italians. They were very, there was a lot of discrimination, even from the Northerners toward the Southerners. South India and its colonies of people. The last residents, Teramo, of course, is the town they came from. The final destination, it's scrawled there, Philadelphia. Whether holding a ticket for a final destination, and yes, Pietro and Rosario did have a ticket, who paid the passage? For Pietro, it was his brother Luigi, who had immigrated the year before in 1902, and for Rosaria, it was her husband, Francesco, who was already here. And lastly, that we can see on this manifest, is how much money, whether in possession of $30 or upward, and if less, how much. And we can see here that Rosaria and Pietro each had boarded with a little more money, but after the end, when this was crossed out, when they arrived in the U.S., and they ended up arriving with $9 each. Not a fortune to start a new life. All right, steerage class, as we said, was a very unpleasant journey. Crowded, unsanitary conditions. They were on the bottom of steamships. They had whatever luggage they managed to carry on the boat was shoved in a corner in the little area they were allowed next to their bed. They were given some metal dishes that they held throughout the journey. They had to wash with cold salt water from the sea. Very uncomfortable. The journey took for Rosaria about 17 days. That was about an average. 2 weeks was about an average with the steamships. And when the ship returned, this is an idea of what the area was like, when the ship went back to Italy from the States, the space that the immigrants had occupied was taken by cargo, such as wood and cotton and other stuff. So, not much. Okay, when the immigrants arrived, someone did a survey. This is from 1902, a survey of all these different races and how much money they arrived with. So we can see that the Northern Italians topped the list with $23.73. The Irish are somewhere in the middle with $17.10. And the Southern Italians, $8.67 on average. Very little. So they were not considered great citizens for that reason and other reasons as well. So here is a ship crossing the ocean. This is actually the SS Cretic, which is the ship that Father Shalaba actually came on. But as they approached the United States, the first thing that immigrants would see is this. And of course, this was erected sometime in the 1880s. A gift from France, as everyone knows, and inscribed somewhere on the base of the monument are the words from Emma Lazarus, the words from her poem, "Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, and to be free." So it was very applicable to the poor immigrants that were arriving. Then the next place they saw was Ellis Island, which was a small island in New York Harbor that processed probably three-quarters of all the immigrants that ever came to this country. It was built in 1892 and was finally closed in 1954. So this processed several tens of millions of people, thousands and thousands each day, through the peak periods of immigration in the early 1900s. Some Italian immigration figures by decade, starting as a sort of a trickle between 1851 and 1860, only about 9,000 Italians came over. That grew a little bit 1861 to 1870, but still not too many. After unification in 1870, you can see that there's a fivefold increase. After the famine of 1880 and some other natural disasters and just generally declining conditions in Italy, another almost fivefold increase here. 1891 to 1900, double. 1900 to 1910, when really the peak of immigration happened, over 2 million people. And approximately another 2 million more in the period up to 1924 when a new quota act legislated by the government here, and I can say that the negative sentiment toward Italian South from the South in particular was instrumental in getting that legislation enacted in 1924. So Italians from the South were allowed a very small number, I think it was in the few thousands by 1924, so immigration just about stopped at that point. So from 1820 to 1924, about 4,500,000 Italians came to the U.S., and again, almost twice as many emigrated to other parts of the world. Out of those 4,500,000, most ended up staying. More than half, actually, ended up staying. Many did go back after making a small, after making some sort of a living here, went back and joined their family back in Italy. But most ended up staying. Okay. So here are some Italian immigrants getting off the ship and crossing the pier to end up and get processed at Ellis Island. This is called the Great Hall in Ellis Island, where thousands would wait to be processed. Of course, first and second class were given a cursory glance at how they could go, because they had money, they were okay. These penniless immigrants, or very poor immigrants, had to wait for a few hours and wait to be processed here. Now, as they exited the ship, there was an inspector already there who would examine them for obvious conditions that may prevent them from being good citizens or able to take care of themselves. Anything like eye disease, an infirmity that would not allow them to work, some scalp issues, any contagious disease that they could glance, or somebody that was likely to become a public charge. And here are some reasons that the inspector that was inspecting them as they got off the ship would put a chalk mark on their coats that would be seen later on, and if there was a chalk mark, that person would be detained for further questioning at the next stage. But some of the reasons that people could be refused were what they termed a loathsome or contagious disease, and that could be something like trachoma, which was contagious, or cholera, something called flavus, which was a disease, a fungus of the scalp, any physical or mental handicap, women traveling alone because it was thought that they could not support themselves except possibly by prostitution, anyone likely to become a public charge, which is someone who could not take care of him or herself, did not seem to be able to. So they were called, there was a term scratched up with a chalk on their coat, LPC. Anyone, of course, guilty of a crime, if they were found to be guilty of a crime, and men under a labor contract, the padron system was a system that had been used whereby a man would go to Italy and contract with some men, he would pay their passage over, bring them here, and in exchange for his being there, having found them a job, they would have to pay him out of their wages for room, board, and other things, and they were pretty much at his mercy, and that became outlawed because of the abuses. So if they were found to be coming over under this labor contract, they were not allowed admittance and were deported. These are some of the detention codes that were scratched onto their coats. E meant something wrong with their eyes, H for heart, L for leg, SC for scalp, X for mental disease, and LPC likely to become a public charge. For some got clever after a while and just erased the chalk marks and were able to get through that way. So after the medical inspection, there was the legal inspection where their what they had written on the ship manifest was they were cross-examined against that information and asked again all the details to see if they jived. And once they were cleared, of which maybe only 10% were detained for further questioning, and really only 2% were not allowed entry and deported. So most people did make it through. And here they are, some somewhat, I suppose, happy immigrants who have made it through and are now in the ticket office waiting to get a ticket to their final destination in the United States. So we can imagine what they are going through. Now, Before we continue with the journey of Rosaria, who has now arrived in Philadelphia on the train, her husband met her at the Ellis Island and taken her to Philadelphia. We're now going to go back a little bit and see what Philadelphia was like in the late 1800s, and to see what the sort of conditions that the immigrants arrived in. So here is Eastern Pennsylvania in the mid-1800s. We have Philadelphia here and here Harrisburg. So this area was pretty much farmland. Philadelphia was inhabited by many wealthy families, old money, lived in Philadelphia and were very comfortably installed there until the mid-1850s, when immigrants started coming, and that wave of immigration was particularly the Irish and the Germans. And they, of course, immigrants usually flocked to cities where jobs could be found easily. So the wealthy Philadelphians were less comfortable as the poor immigrants invaded their neighborhoods. So at this time as well, the Pennsylvania Railroad built what they call their main line out of Philadelphia, which is the railroad that we have running right up here, from Philadelphia all the way out to downtown, well, initially up to Paoli. And with the advent of this railroad, the wealthy Philadelphians found it interesting to move west along the main line and build themselves houses very close to the railroad all along, because now, this is of course before the automobile, so the train has become an efficient and easy way to travel. And so they build their summer homes all along the main line and still retain their Philadelphia addresses, of course, because Philadelphia is where they're at. And in particular, we're going to look at this area surrounded in blue here, the little town called Eagle, which is the old name of Stratford. So, as the wealthy Philadelphians are moving out west and building their homes, they are suddenly confronted with the need for service, because they now have sprawling estates and huge homes in the manner of the British aristocracy, whom they love very much, and they now need servants to join them. So Irish girls from the city come and become the living maids, and Italian men in particular are now recruited to build for in construction, stonemasons, landscapers, gardeners, all sorts of things like that they now need. So, next is the area that was called at one time Eagle, or Spread Eagle, named after, if you go to the next slide, it's a close-up of this area. Spread Eagle was the name of this train station up here, and it was named after the Spread Eagle Inn, or hotel, down here in this corner. I've got a blue circle around the area that our parish now is. Our church is actually right there. This is Old Eagle School. There's a bit of a tilt to the map if you can see the star here. This is the north. Old Eagle School is this. This is Lancaster Pike. And the train station is not where it is now, but it was a little further west along the tracks and called Spread Eagle. So at some point in the 1880s, the Pennsylvania Railroad decided to raise the tracks, because they had all been level crossings up to now. And at this time, they wanted to move the station down to here. This particular land right here had been bought up by someone called John Langdon Wentworth. And that is the part now, I don't know if you know the area, Homestead Avenue, who's right through here now. John Langdon Wentworth was a New Englander who had come down from Connecticut, I think, and was very wealthy and had bought the land that was here and set himself up a beautiful mansion and called his estate Stratford, because he claimed descent from Thomas Wentworth, 1st Earl of Stratford, who was a big wig in England in the time of Charles I, so he was a very old, blue-blood kind of guy. And he was only too happy to sell a piece of land to the Pennsylvania Railroad, and at that time also gave the name Stratford to the station, and then eventually the whole village became known as Stratford. So Just a couple of things on this slide first. Of course, the spread eagle inn here was one of the inns that was all along the Lancaster Pike, important in the time of the Conestoga wagons before the railroad, actually. It was the main artery between Philadelphia and Lancaster, the Lancaster Pike was, rather. And the Spread Eagle Inn was one of the inns along the way where people could stop and get refreshment or stay overnight as they made their way westward. And other thing I want to bring your attention to is something that was right on the corner where Old Eagle School bends, right there on the east side of the road. And that was an ancient chestnut tree. And that would have been right on the corner of our parking lot, right probably at the middle of Fairfield Lane, a gigantic chestnut tree that has since been removed, but we'll talk about it in a minute. This was the Spread Eagle Inn in 1795. This is Lancaster Pike, a dirt road at the time. It also is famous for having been the first hard-packed stone road in the United States. So here we see a jolly innkeeper here welcoming some people, and the Conestoga wagon lumbering eastward toward Philadelphia. This is looking east along the pike. There is a story that we have about George Washington actually having stopped at this inn to refresh himself with some of his soldiers. And upon leaving, they left and came down Lancaster Pike to the corner of Old Eagle School Road, and they turned the corner and came up to this tree. This is our sentinel chestnut tree. And George Washington asked one of the soldiers to climb up the tree and take a look around. And from there, he could see very far. And it became a sentinel chestnut along with a bunch of other chestnuts. Apparently there was one further down on Westwood Avenue and another one up at the Doyle Nurseries and then again in Valley Forge. They would chop the top off and lay a platform, and the soldiers would sit up there and be able to signal to one another all along in case they noticed some British approaching. Of course, this was during the British occupation of Philadelphia. So it became known as the Sentinel Chestnut or the Washington Sentry Tree. And it was there when our church was built, and so would have provided some shade for the festa that the parish had. But because it was a chestnut tree that afflicted with the disease that afflicted all the chestnuts in the area and killed it, and then it was chopped down sometime in the mid-1920s. Okay, now we are in 1900, and we see that the land here is all owned by someone called John Palmer. What we're particularly interested in here is this little green spot with a little building on it. The green indicates that it's an institution and not a residence or a business. That was a little wood frame building called Stratford Hall. It's probably right where the parking lot of that building on 85 Old Eagle School Road is now, up the road. Stratford Hall was originally built by a group of businessmen who had built it as a meeting hall for themselves. And it was built in 1891 and later used by a group of people who conducted a Sunday school there from the St. David's Church. And it became known as the Stratford Hall because of that. It was the Stratford Union Sunday School that used it. Now, on other maps, the building is called A.M.M. Hall, which is probably more appropriate to what it was originally built for. A.M.M. standing for American Mechanics Meeting Hall. The American Mechanics were a secret society with a very nativist bent. And the nativists were those, of course, who were anti-immigration. So, interestingly, this would become the first chapel of Our Lady of the Assumption by some, as fate would have it. That's all on this slide, I believe. All right, next we jump to 1907. By this time, someone by the name of Henry Drinker Riley has bought all the land that our parish now owns. He owns about 30 acres at this spot, and he has set himself a little poultry and egg farm. Now we're going to resume our story with Rosanna, who is with the Italian immigrants, first of all. By this time, in 1907, many Italians have moved out to this area where they have set up homes along Lancaster Pike or over here in the Devon area or down over here in Wayne. I don't know if anyone's getting aware. This is Old People School Road. This is the train tracks. This is the Lancaster Avenue. So our church will eventually end up here. The Italians, of course, came over, were overwhelmingly Catholic. And when they moved here, what they looked for was places to go to Mass. The only available places for Catholic churches was about 2 miles east in Berwyn at St. Monica's, or about 1 mile west at St. Catherine's in Wayne. So, did I say it the other way? East, I'm sorry. West Berwyn and east to St. Catherine's, excuse me. That's what they tried. The Italians would go to these churches. It was a long walk, but they did try. However, the language was a big issue, and the religious practices between the Irish and the Italian were very different. And neither felt comfortable with that of the other. And it was not a friendly situation. It was not comfortable for the Italians assisting at these churches. So some of them stopped going so regularly. One person, Rosaria, by this time she was living with her husband and two children at this house here on Lancaster Pike. She was a very devout and spiritual person and began to be very worried about the spiritual welfare of her Italian community. So she did something remarkable. She wrote a letter to Pope Pius X at the Vatican and explained the situation of the Italian immigrants and begged him to do something, send an Italian priest to help her people. Well, within a few months, this of course was in 1907, within a few months, Archbishop Ryan appointed Father Emilius Landolfi to found a new parish. He was actually setting up a parish already in Chester, but he was pulled away from there. I don't know why, but he came and founded and was appointed to found a new parish for Italians on the mainland. So this is Rosaria in 1907. She is 22 years old. This is her husband Francesco, and these are her two daughters at the time. This is Amelia, and this is Adalgisa, who some of you may know as Margie, later Margie Ferrari. And she is, and one of our parishioners, Rosemary Heim, I don't know if she's here today, is her daughter. So this was taken in 1907. Is Amelia still living? She is still alive, obviously, I guess. Okay. And when Father Landolfi arrived in Stratford, the first thing he did was meet the Di Lorenzos and the Italian community. And then he found out that Henry Drinker Riley had this little wood frame building that he was going to demolish. He had thrown out Stratford Union Sunday School and was now waiting to tear it down. And Father Landolfi showed up and asked to purchase it, and when he did, he went to the Archdiocese and asked permission to purchase it with the little money that he had collected from the Italian community, $1,500. And it was carried. It says, Reverend A. Landolfi, rector of Assumption Italian Church of Stratford, applied for the sum of $1,500 to be used for house lot and stables in Stratford for about $5,000. Carried. So it was approved. This is the first instance of a parish name, 1910, February 10th, 1910, was the first instance of our parish name. I forgot to put the date, but it was February 10th. So, within a month of this agreement, Father Landolfi and the men of the parish moved the little Carriage Hall is now. The wood frame building was set there sometime at the end of March 1908. And it became the first chapel of Our Lady of the Assumption. And it was blessed on June 7th, 1908, by the pastor of St. Catherine's of Wayne, Father O'Keefe, who actually helped the parish very much. The two pastors of Our Lady of St. Catherine's were extremely helpful for the struggling Italian community, and them, and as well as many of their parishioners. Okay. The first three pastors that we had, Father Landolfi stayed less than a year, and the next two pastors also were here just a short time. So the parish was in a very rough condition with no permanent priest until Father Shalala came to the rescue. He was appointed in 1911, August 11th, by Archbishop Prendergast at the time, and he... He is the one that has really established the parish and gave it the strength that it eventually had. He was born in Sicily, so he's not an Abruzzese like his parishioners. Born in Messina, Sicily, he emigrated in 1907, and luckily, because in 1908 he's from Messina. In 1908 there was a devastating earthquake in Messina that destroyed probably over 200,000 people. So he made it out in time for us. And Father Shalava had this wooden chapel. This is the wooden chapel back in... This picture was actually taken about 10 years later in 1921. So it's probably in worse shape than it was when he started, but it was still already 20 years old and not very well taken care of, not a permanent building to begin with, so it was a ramshackle kind of a thing. The main floor was the church, and the pastor lived upstairs, and this is his congregation. Now, Father Shalava was really a father to his congregation, loved them dearly, and knew that this parish could not survive with a building like this. So he got the idea to build a stone church. He first applied to buy some land. Now, back from 1911 and through the many years following, the average yearly intake of collections from the entire parish was less than $1,000. That's maybe $20 a week, if that. And so Father Shalaba, however, who was extremely, intrepid, he had a great faith in Providence and also his people, and really wanted something to work. He applied for the sum of $15,000 from the Archdiocese. He asked for a loan of $15,000, which they refused outright. They, knowing that the parish only made $1,000 a year, they knew that they just didn't even want to bother with it. So this is the letter that he wrote upon receiving the refusal. Dear Archbishop, he went right to the top. The consultors were the ones who had refused him. They are priests who advise the Archbishop. Was Dougherty at the time, Archbishop Dougherty. Father Shalava writes to him, he says, I know my people Italian to the sacraments they know. His English was a little rough. They'd be glad to have something honorable, and I am sure they will pay when I make for them the De Vita Representatio, that's the bill, for the church, and show to them that they have some part more than Dago. So he knew the discrimination that they were undergoing at the time. He knew this was an epithet that was often used against Italians, and as well as others. But he wants his people to have something that they can be proud of. When I show them something material, they pay. And then the next page, I am too poor to do much, but I am sure your grace will help me to save the souls of my poor people. I am ashamed to be too poor to the Archbishop. Your obedient servant in Christ, he kisses your ring, Antonio Shalava. So that is what he was trying to plead with the Archbishop to please help him out. So, something happened then. This was in April 1920. A few months later, Henry Draper Wiley, who owned the property, He deeds the property to, if this says deed here, in case you might get it, this is taken from the Chester County Archives, Recorder of Deeds. It's a big book. From Lewis A. Wyden and wife to Dennis J. Doherty, Archbishop of Philadelphia. It's dated February 19, 1921, and it is the deed that transferred the property officially from the Wyden estate to us, to Our Lady of the Assumption Parish, in the name of the Archbishop. So, then the next letter that Father Schlaub wrote to the Archdiocese was much more confident. He says, "As I spoke to you on Wednesday, June 1st, I would like to make a cemetery on the church grounds and also build a new church." And he continues, "I also said I would like to build a new stone church 75 by 40 feet. He had an exact idea of what he wanted. He says, "The contractor, an Italian, will build it for $10,000. All his men will work part-time free." And he talks about how much money he has. "My people will be proud to have a new church and are so anxious that many men have promised to work free. And then I sincerely hope your grace will help me. Your obedient servant in Christ, Antonio Schlaub." So we have the property that was purchased is the property that the parish hall is now in Chester County, not the parish hall on this side. But by September 1921, the archdiocese replied, "Okay, you can build a church if you have sufficient land." So they did not have sufficient land at first. So next thing you know, they purchase another bit of land, which is what the church is now on, and the cemetery. It's another 3/4 acre to make a total of 1.5 acres in all. And then the construction on the church can begin. This second piece of land was purchased in October. Already by November 1921, the cornerstone was laid. The contractor that was chosen for the job is James Rosado, right here with his family. And he was to work hand-in-hand with the stonemason Antonio Di Ferdinando, who was known as Maestro Antonio because of his great skill and his craft. So they worked through the winter, through the spring, and so quickly, in fact, that it was ready for dedication between November and August of the next year. It was ready for its dedication as a church. So, there's the church in August of 1922. Father Schlaub proudly standing in front of it right here. If we look at the number of stones in this church, this is the story of the stonework. The entire church was was built out of limestone that was taken from the Howellville quarries down in Howellville over on Sweetsford Road. And the stone was transported, according to Jim Rosado, who was the grandson of the contractor. The stone was transported by horse and wagon all the way from Howellville. So that's way down in the valley. They would have had to come up with all the rock, up the valley, up the hill, on the old Eagle School Road, and dump the stones here, 2 trips a day. And the stone was chipped by hand. It would take probably 1 or 2 days for one guy to chip a stone, maybe 1 or 2 stones. And if you look at the quantity of stone that went into building this church, you can just imagine the amount of men that must have been contributing to this construction to get it ready in just the short 9 months that it took. In back there was the cemetery that was not yet laid out. So Father Schlaub, very proud here, as well as the parishioners, you can imagine them being motivated to be working very hard, because here finally they are building a church of which they can be proud. Something that will stand out in the Stratford. In fact, it was the biggest thing in the Stratford area at the time. There was nothing else of any comparable size. Okay, so this is what the interior looked like back in the old days. This is how it looked between 1922 and 1948. was renovated by the next pastor. Father Shalaba was the pastor from 1911 until 1947 when he died, 36 years. So we see the Blessed Virgin up here in the niche, which she's now over here. This picture was actually taken in 1942 during the funeral of Vincent Capelli, the military funeral. So the church is somewhat worn with time, but it must have been beautiful when it was first done. And it was, that is pretty much it concerning the church now. This is a view of the church now as part of the property. Here it is, the stone church where the rectory was built actually later in 1922. Because the architect warned Father Shalaba that the building that he was living in, that old chapel, was in danger of falling down any minute. So, positively unsafe is the way to put it. So Father Shalaba built a rectory attached. This is a map from 1926. We see here, 1926 was the building of these brick shops that are now on 130, on the corner. We also see that the land has been subdivided, ready for sale to small property owners. This part was purchased by the church. Actually, this part here was purchased by the parish in 1948. This part in 1953 for the school. And then this here in 1993, which is the vicar's house. And that is the sum total of the parish's property today. And this is an aerial view in 1928. There's the church. And you can see there's not much else around. And this is the railroad, as you see. And that is the conclusion of this part. We do have a few slides on our memorable stained glass windows. So we can say just a few words about them. This was all written in our booklet that we published about a year ago on our very special stained glass window to my left right here, which we call the Sullivan Window of Hope for its donors, or the Nativity and Assumption windows for the theme of the windows. These were very important windows in the sense that they were considered worthy enough to travel around, before they were installed in our church, travel around to different museums because of the quality of the workmanship. They were donated by the James Francis Sullivan family on the scrolls on the bottom to the glory of God and the loving memory of Lita Sullivan Hoffman. And this is Lita, a socialite, a beautiful socialite from the early 1900s. The Sullivans were a Philadelphia family, but they also owned a summer home at the Woods in Radnor. And their daughter, Lita, got married in 1918, and within a year had a child, and by tragedy, a week after he was born, she died in She died, and her distraught parents had a window made for her by the Willett Studios, and it was asked to join a tour of American artifacts because it was such a beautiful window. And so they did tour those museums. And the other window, this is a detail, but I forgot to say that one of the special features of this window is the fact that the designer, the craftsperson who made the window, and Lee Willett, used the face of Lita as the face of the Virgin. And at the same time, she reports that they brought the child from New York so I could use his face for the child Jesus. So that is the face of her son, who was also called Albert by after him. So that was a very touching story. And it was installed in our church after touring the museums in 1924. Another window that the Sullivans donated to us is this one on the right, which is never visible, unfortunately, because once the rectory was built, it got completely cut off from light. So it never is visible, unfortunately, unless backlit. And so we do have a picture of it here. It depicts the Assumption of Mary and some angels on the right panel. And this one was donated again by poor Mrs. Sullivan, died the week after Rita, and her name was Mrs. James B. Clues. So there is the window installed in our church. Now, the Sullivans were parishioners of St. Catherine, but they, along with several other Irish members of St. Catherine, but who would sometimes actually come to this parish, installed donated the windows, rather, that make up the first four groups on the side and the side panel. So the fourth window are donated by Irish patrons, and the back of the church are donated by Italians. So the windows were installed from front to back. So in chronological order, they went this way. And the last two windows installed were by Rosaria and her husband, Rosaria Di Lorenzo and her husband, and they are at the very back of the church at the entrance. And that pretty much concludes our story. This is actually the cover of our new book. There is so much more to say that can be opened. We can only cover a little bit today, but the many, many more details will be in the book that is actually going to press tomorrow. After much work and time, we're relieved, Celia and I. And we have, if you're interested in purchasing a copy of the book, advance orders, there are order forms available at the entrance, as well as a sample copy. So it's just a working copy of the book that you can leaf through and see. And we hope you enjoyed the presentation today and learned a little bit more about the community.